Beneath a dusty, sun-baked mound in northern Syria, a team of Italian archaeologists have uncovered one of the most spectacular finds of all time, the remains of an ancient kingdom that may be the source for many of the figures and tales described in the Old Testament. That kingdom was Ebla, a Semitic civilization that flourished more than 4,000 years ago, one that was known only by occasional references in ancient Sumerian, Akkadian, Hittite, and Egyptian texts. Sent by the University of Rome to select a second millennium Phoenician or Aramean site for excavation, a young archaeologist just 23 years old, Paolo Mattei, chose instead a third millennium Syrian site 30 miles south of Aleppo. In his own account, he says, "In 1963, I was sent by the University of Rome to choose a site in Syria, preferably Phoenician or Aramean. Our colleagues there showed me various sites where we might work. Among them was a large mound called Tel Mardik, on the surface of which a large basin of sculptured basalt had been found, a magnificent witness to Syrian art at the beginning of the year 2000 BC. We know almost nothing of this period in Syria, although we do know something of the art of the first thousand millennium period called Neo-Hittite." He says, "Let me say that in choosing Tel Mardik, I had high hopes of finding, if only because of its great size, some traces of ancient Syrian civilization. These hopes were happily borne out by the discovery of the royal palace, contemporary with Hammurabi of Babylon, and then totally confirmed by the emergence of the royal palace and the state archives of the great Akkad epoch, nearly 2500 BC. I hope that Mardik might yet bring to light knowledge of the periods before Sargon of Akkad. There is no doubt that around 2500 years before Christ, Syria became a great cultural center. Our task now is to continue to dig exhaustively the great palace of the era of Sargon of Akkad, and also to find and reconstruct the origins of that era." He says, "I had an idea it might turn out to have a character all its own, which tended to be confirmed by the Tel Mardik surface finds. And aside from my interest in these finds, I wanted a large site. Tel Mardik is a trapezoidal tell of about 140 acres, one of the largest in Syria. So on returning to Rome, I proposed that our university ask for permission to excavate there." Our Syrian colleagues were greatly interested in this project, particularly as the site was being dug by tomb robbers. Damascus was very generous in allowing us to have it. We've always had the most pleasant relationships with our colleagues in Damascus, as well as in Aleppo. Now, since 1964, we have worked every year with all the possible kindness from the Syrian authorities. Some of you may have seen in the recent Reader's Digest this summer an article called "Unearthing the Secrets of a Forgotten Kingdom." Here he talks about that nearly half mile in diameter mound of earth that's about 3/4 of a mile off to the left side of the road going north to Aleppo. An individual who visits there by the name of Hughes stated, "All along that hillside lived the people of Ebla. At the top we found the temples of their gods and palaces of their kings." He stood there and thought about ancient times. Here was Ebla, a tremendous empire, city-state, at the head of a thriving empire around 2300 BC, rich in commerce, art, letters, with conquering kings who carried its influence far and wide. Totally unknown until the last few years. These discoveries reveal a new culture, a new language, a new history. A man by the name of Professor Ignace J. Gelb simply says they're sensational. In the 1930s, two French expeditions made spectacular discoveries of ancient cities called Ugarit and Mari. Some of you may have read about these, and if you've taken archaeology classes at all in school, you may have learned about the tablets of Mari and the parallels to the book, the Old Testament. These particular cities flourished 1900 BC down to about 1200 BC. But what about the period before them? Who were their predecessors? Where were the ancients who preceded them? This was what this young archaeologist wanted to unveil. So he was attracted to Tel Mardik, this huge 140-acre mound 35 miles southwest of Aleppo. He was convinced that somewhere below, a rich, sophisticated society had once thrived. They dug diagonally across the mound, starting in the southwest and along the top and towards the northeast, hardly digging more than a few percent of the entire mound. Years went by. After digging began, they found a massive city gate in 1966 and 67, part of a royal palace, and a year later, a large temple. But what city was it? They didn't know at the time. One day in 1968, diggers called him to come and investigate a broken torso of a royal statue. On its shoulder and chest could be seen the wedge-shaped slashes of history's first known writing, ancient cuneiform, meaning wedge-shaped. A team member who could read Akkadian, one of the earliest Mesopotamian languages, translated the 26 lines. Apparently a dedication to a local goddess. On the seventh line, he came to the words, in Ebla. Ebla. The team members gasped. Could this be the mysterious Ebla mentioned in inscriptions? Only a few places found in Mesopotamia and Egypt. Many scientists had suspected that its site might be somewhere else, but they decided that they had indeed found ancient Ebla. Now, scientists and scholars rejected it for nearly a year. In fact, one very famous scientist in Germany wrote a very large article in a prestigious magazine denouncing that this could be the city of Ebla because there was an ancient reference found in 1882 referring to the city and its mountains and its mountainous area. There was even a map found in an ancient city called Nuzi that showed in one quarter of the map a city, a place called Ebla. But nevertheless, they began to find some more information that confirmed it. In 1973, they began to find ruins at a deeper and therefore older level. Pottery fragments, painstakingly dug out, sorted, washed, and cataloged, showed that the oldest city that they were now uncovering dated back at least 2,400 years before the time of Christ. At this new level, they came upon the ruins of a three-story palace with a spacious audience court, stairway, and several paved rooms. Evidences that the city had been destroyed by fire, 2250 BC. Then in 1974, while clearing out one of the rooms, the Italians got verification that this was the city of Ebla. A workman's shovel lifted two rounded objects, each bearing 20 minute inscriptions. Dusting them off, the excavators found that they were hard clay tablets about the size of the palm of your hand, covered with cuneiform writing. They found 42 of such tablets inscribed. No one in the expedition could read them. So they fired off a telegram to Rome, invited a man by the name of Giovanni Pettinato, who hurried to Syria. He was baffled. He says, I cannot understand a single word. The signs were ordinary cuneiform, but the words were neither ancient Akkadian nor Sumerian, the earliest languages known. It was a new one. In 1975, the team continued to uncover a room next to the palace. The entrance there, they found 1,000 more tablets on the floor. The digging season was almost over when workmen in another room discovered the find of a lifetime. By the time they cleaned out that room, they had another 15,000 tablets. Of these, 100 were dictionaries, giving the name of Sumerian equivalents for more than 3,000 words of this ancient language. This permitted them then to decipher and almost immediately begin to read the tablets. For the Italians, it was soon confirmed they had discovered the world's oldest state archive, official records of the kingdom of Ebla. Previous reports and rumors do not begin to indicate the true dimensions and discovery and its importance for ancient, Near Eastern, and biblical studies. Those tablets were found about 13 feet below the surface of an arid expanse at Tel Mardik, have, of course, excited archaeologists throughout the world. Because of the tablets, ancient Syria is beginning to be recognized as the rival of ancient Egypt and Mesopotamia in the history of civilization. Pettinato, now 41, a language expert who had been reading the tablets, said they shed light on the history of the Jewish people. Now, that statement was made several years ago. The Ebla tablets list a queen after the king in the power of hierarchy, and the king was assisted by two prince ministers and by a council of elders. It wasn't very long after the first announcements were made that those of us who were LDS began to realize that there was additional significant things in the tablets of Ebla that we could become interested in. Tilmardik, ancient Ebla, is most interesting between 2400 and 1600 years before the time of Christ. This is the period of the great flowering of that city and kingdom. After 1600, Mardik became a ruin. One could see few remains, mostly buildings. At the end of the third millennium and the beginning of the second, Ebla certainly played a very important part in Syrian history, and also the history of Near Eastern civilization in general. All of it will have to be rewritten. In 1964, when the University of Rome, through the Italian Archaeological Mission in Syria, began the systematic exploration, it had a twofold purpose in mind. First, to find and acquire detailed information about the settlements previous to 2000 BC, the epoch called the Old Syrian. And the other, of course, to recover evidence for the oldest and the most obscure phases of history prior to 2000 BC. All of the finds pointed to the conclusion that Tilmardik concealed the ruins of a very important center of North Syria, one that may have remained politically dominant until Yarmulim of Yamahat about the year 1820 BC. Then it diminished and finally was destroyed and became a ruin about 1600 BC. The excavation started in 1964. Brilliantly confirmed the hope of the young men, but you know, for a period of time they thought they were going to be lost in total obscurity. In fact, they were even being chided at one period of time that possibly they had selected the wrong area to dig, and it was nearly 10 years. And in the life of a young person, that is a big gap in his professional life. And yet, of course, their highest hopes have been realized. They exposed the part of a royal palace in the northern area of the Acropolis, dating to the period of the Amorite dynasties, the great temple, now called Temple D, in the western part of the Acropolis, and temples B and C were also found in the northwest and northern area of the lower city. And they've excavated such a little part of the ruin and the mound that we know that they will be making large and magnificent discoveries here in the future. They are continuing their excavations. The discovery in 1968 of that torso of a statue with the dedicatory inscription in Akkadian permitted the identification of the site and was finally confirmed. Now I have maps here showing the size of the ruin, and from your distance you can get an idea perhaps. And as we go along, I'll circulate some pictures of the tablets. In the 20s, Syria was the scene of some major excavations, but had been long and seriously neglected by archaeologists. But none of these were as ancient as Ebla, however. The discovery of Ugarit on the coast by Claude Schaefer revealed an original civilization, but it was, of course, after 2000 BC, quite young compared to what they were seeking. And then Parrot, the French archaeologist, had found Mari, and it also was important. In fact, it had elucidated so much of biblical material. Now they expect many extraordinary new discoveries. He says, we were lucky enough in 1973 to find a palace of amazing importance, architecturally and from the point of view of its period otherwise. In the courtyard was found in 1975 the state archives. Now they think they've only found annexes, really. They found the one little room with 42 tablets, and then another one with 1,000, and then another 15,000. Now as of this year, crates containing 42,000 tablets are in circulation and being shipped to different places for study, analysis, and cleaning. And they still think they are going to find the library, the great archive. Most of these are business and transactions and appear to have been available in the immediate courtyard of the king, who sat there in council, who would then distribute gold and silver or take it and sign individuals out for trade and negotiations of things of this kind. So as a consequence, they feel that they're yet going to find something tremendous. The importance of these tablets depends on two facts. First, they are part of the state archive of a great empire, of which all memory had been lost in the historical tradition of the Near East. Second, they are written in the cuneiform system of the Mesopotamian cultures, but in a language for which heretofore there had been no documentation, although several scholars had hypothesized this language for the year 3000 BC or earlier. This is an ancient Northwest Semitic dialect. The epigrapher of the expedition defines it as Paleo-Canaanite, meaning very ancient Canaanitic, very much related to Hebrew and to Amorite languages. It has many similarities to the Phoenician and the Hebrew. We can say definitely that the language of Ebla is neither Phoenician nor Hebrew, as now documented. They're 1,000 years older than both. The wife of the archaeologist was asked, how did you and your husband feel when you found the tablets? Did you say, Eureka? She said, when I saw the great quantity of tablets, for she's an archaeologist in her own right, regularly arranged on the shelves, it was an astonishing sight. I couldn't believe we had discovered such an immense, beautiful, and important treasure. Even my husband, who rarely loses his sang-froid, found it an emotional experience. He suddenly felt like an archaeologist of the last century, like Botha discovering the archives of Ashurbanipal, or Hilprecht the tablets of Nippur, or Rawlinson when he reached the Bithystian rock area nearly 125 years ago. He said all of these, including the bedrooms, all the rooms, the photography room, the bedrooms, and the bathrooms and everything were used to store the tablets as they were being dug. They worked in two teams. They worked all day and they worked all night. We divided and did all possible to clean and register them and pack them in crates for shipment to the Aleppo Museum. Ebla is only one of the large cities, only one of the discoveries of an extraordinary civilization. Archaeology is in a tremendous re-examination period right now. They got to go back and start over in many areas and build on what they've already done. Syria no longer can be considered merely a crossroads, but rather an original great cultural center of the ancient world. Ebla, along with Aleppo, Carchemish and Katna, was one of the major creative centers of that old Syrian culture known to us principally from the Alaka and from individual monuments at Ugarit and Mari, where brief references had been made. Ebla was also a center of considerable power. The rise of Yamkad around 1800 BC could have brought about the weakening, if not the annihilation, of Ebla's political power, which probably had lasted for more than 600 years. With one or two interjections there. Ebla, a city of northern Syria, mentioned for the first time in Sumerian economic texts about 2350 BC, and afterwards in historical inscriptions of Sargon, will of course be receiving much attention in the future activities of archaeologists. A book will be prepared and published by fall. It's been postulated that Ebla must have been the urban center of the late early Syrian culture before 3000 BC. It is likely that an individual by the name of Naram Sin of Akkad, who boasts in his triumphal inscriptions of the conquests of Armanum and Ebla, cities uncaptured since the creation of man, was responsible for the destruction of the palace and the burning of the city 2250 BC. The tablets had all been on wooden shelves, arranged along the walls of some of the rooms, and apparently under the conflagration that burned the palace and the city, the tablets just fell in place when the wood burned below them, and that's where they were found. The elements of archaeological evidence are now filled out by decisive textual data furnished by documents of the State Archives of Ebla. These documents actually permit the reconstruction of a dynasty of at least six kings. The third of these is an interesting person. His name is Ebram. Was he a contemporary of Sargon of Akkad? Was he perhaps also involved in the king list and patriarchal list from Noah to Abraham, who mentions a man by the name of Eber? This is part of the thing we'll be talking about this evening and part of the problems that confront some of the archaeologists. The archives themselves, the first epigraphic finds in Tel Mardik were made in 1974 when some 42 cuneiform tablets were discovered on the floor in one of the long rooms of the building being excavated. The preliminary study of these tablets revealed that they were written in very ancient Northwest Semitic language, provisionally called Paleo or Old Canaanite. And they're still debating about that, and I'll give you some references. The designation Old Canaanite for the language of Ebla also tends to stress the similarities to Phoenician and Hebrew. And this is as it should be, especially if we take consideration of the Old Testament and the brass plates of the Book of Mormon. In 1975, it was possible to identify two small rooms. In the smaller of the two rooms, which had been completely excavated, there was a storeroom, and here a limited number of tablets were arranged on high shelves built into the walls. 1,000 tablets were recovered there. The larger room was a library, or more properly, one of the rooms of a court library where numerous documents were stored on wooden shelves. They likewise had fallen when the shelves had burned. Now this constitutes an extraordinary example of a surviving ancient library. One should recall that the outstanding examples of ancient libraries in the Near East, such as the Neo-Sumerian and Old Babylonian libraries of Nippur and the Neo-Assyrian library of Nineveh, were discovered nearly 100 years ago. Some of you have heard about the library of Ashurbanipal and the Babylonian tablets and things of this kind. Well, this is what they're really referring to. But this was, of course, one of the most complete surviving ancient libraries ever found. The documents in the smaller storeroom were found to be mostly economic and administrative in character, as we mentioned earlier. But in the library, where the tablets collected numbered nearly 15,000 in the third room, the majority were international, showing textile trade, dealings, treaties, payments of taxes and tributes in metals, chiefly silver and gold, and included a collection of words in Sumerian, as I mentioned, 100 dictionary tablets, and bilingual vocabularies in Sumerian and Eblitic, sometimes with the Sumerian pronunciation even provided. This was tremendously exciting and interesting because then they could move immediately to the identification of the language and read it out very well. There was incantation, parts of hymns, historical texts of various sorts, and among the most frequently royal ordinances concerning matters such as distribution of goods and reports regarding topics of government, one such as the report of General Yanana Dagan to the King of Ebla. He had made the conquest of Mari and the defeat of its king. Finally, there are some international treaties, the most important being that between Ebla and Asher. So all of these histories that are now in ancient books, such as this one right here, the first cities, and this is not a very old book, has to be entirely rewritten. When the royal palace, G, was destroyed by fire, probably set a fire by Naram Sin's army, the flames devoured the wooden shells and the tablets and settled on top of one another. Some of the tablets, this is the color and size of some of them. I think you can see that fairly well. They're larger than the palm of your hand, most of them. Some of them are 18 feet long. Some with 3,000 lines of writing on them. They had been kept, the larger ones, on the ground below the shelves. The writing, the oldest Northwest Semitic tongue ever identified, was pretty well accepted by 1975. And they called the language Eblitic as well, after the city. It was written with a very generous use of Sumerian locograms. And you're all familiar with that. You make a dollar sign to mean dollar, right? Or a little cent sign to mean cents, or a little percent sign to mean percent. They use that kind of thing too. That's about all it really amounts to. It was doubtless the language of culture in the royal chancellery of Ebla around 2400 BC, and seems already to have had its literary tradition at that time, so there's an earlier history that we now look for, its predecessors. And there's other implications there too. And I'll pass around this picture so you can see that room where the 15,000 tablets were found in the Royal Palace G. If you'd like to pass that around. Now, since up to now, nothing had been known of the glyptic art of the Syrian area in the old Akkadian period. This corpus of late earlier Syrian seals, because there are many seals and impressions of seals also found in addition. These are of an exceptional documentation nature as well. The oldest reigns of the dynasty of Ebla show autonomy of conception and technique in artistic composition, totally outside the theories of many of the historians. Like I say, everything's thrust back another 1,000 to 1,500 years. It represents the independent but also parallel expression of a taste, a technique, an architectural development that was contemporary and different from nearly all of the cities known of its time and afterwards. Another fundamental document of the archives, which we cannot date precisely, since no king is mentioned, lists cities which are in the hand of the king of Ebla, including among them such cities as Kanish and Akkad. A letter that must be dated shortly before the destruction of 2250 BC that was put into the end of the royal archive contains a request from the king of Ebla to the king Kamazi, a city who we don't know where it's located, but which is apparently east of the Tigris, to send him good soldiers. They think probably the reason why the city finally was destroyed and overcame is because it was depending too much upon mercenary soldiers. Something to look forward in our own time to be careful about. One must recognize then, in a period of balance, tension, and contrast, there were great powers, sometimes in conflict, and sometimes one or another emerged in those ancient times. Ebla was one of the greatest of empires. Just imagine finding an empire as great as the Roman Empire that you'd never known about before. That's what they've done. The highest institution, Ebla, is represented by the king, who appears in the commercial statements always in the first position, followed hierarchically by the queen. In governmental activities, the king is helped by a group of officials who are individual, called by the Sumerian word, judges. And this has implications as well from the Book of Mormon standpoint. They are sometimes called fathers. Where did the Book of Mormon get the doctrines of judges from and its utilization? Mostly from the brass plate, which had a more complete history from the time of Adam down to 600 B.C. So there's implications there for students of the Book of Mormon to examine and to follow through on. Ebla, one may at least say that the texts of the archives contain evidence for at least three forms of government and territorial control. This will stimulate research as well. You'll find parallels to their government, the Council of Elders and Judges, in the Book of Mormon and in the practice of the Latter-day Saints in these days. The flourishing of Ebla seems to have been covered by oblivion after the centuries pass. The rediscovery opens up many new areas. Ebla must have maintained in the titles of its kings testimony to contact with Mesopotamia culture, which date back to as early as maybe 3300 B.C., and perhaps even earlier. The king lists found in one area, the third king, contemporary perhaps of Sargon, about 2400 B.C., this man Ebram, has been equated by one scholar with Eber among the patriarchs from the time of Adam on down, from Noah on down. It might be recalled that Naram-Sin of Akkad, himself the destroyer of Ebla, was the first in Mesopotamia to call himself the king of the four regions. This universalistic conception of Akkad in the early Syrian in origin was assumed by only him and handed down by him to Mesopotamian tradition, at least as far as the record now goes. The early Syrian culture, now emerging from these great discoveries, shows that there had been achieved, in certain respects, extraordinary originality. We can now document moments in political history which involve Ebla, Mari, Asher, and Akkad, and which are disposed along of an arc of nearly 150 years. We can now study in detail the structure of conspicuous sectors of the economy, industry and finances of a major, perhaps the major center of early Syrian culture. Now, toponyms mentioned in the text will allow us also to rewrite, in fact, this author here says, to actually write a political geography of the entire Near East. Before the discovery of the Ebla archives, the oldest group of texts available in a Northwest Semitic language was the Ugaritic corpus. That was a city found on the Mediterranean coast. This was found going back about 1500 B.C. The Ebla text would represent, if no further text should be found, one of the three major groups of documents of the ancient Semitic languages of antiquity. The great number of texts. Texts make the archive as a whole an extraordinary instrument for the study of these ancient languages. Now, Ebla appears fundamental to the question of the origin and development of successive phases of the urban cultures of Syria and the people who descended from Noah following the flood, their distribution, their geographical location. And then, of course, the question arises about the tower and the confusion of tongues and the distributions of peoples. These have important implications from a Mormon standpoint. In the third place, Ebla will surely prove a landmark in mapping the cultural continuity of ancient Syria. The reality of early Syrian Ebla which must constitute the basis for all research that intends to study the cultural traditionally defined as Canaanite, the culture in which one can recognize the ambience, within which, in a complex process of influence reaction, there occurred the great religious experience of the Old Testament. Now, I know a lot of that history and that background and the language and everything might be just a little bit over some of your heads, but then since this tape provides that background and history and discovery data, then I don't have to repeat that in some future talks. I can just refer to the tape, you see, and we can get around to things maybe a little more interesting from an individual standpoint. One other scholar writes that the path of culture seems to have run from ancient Sumer down to the south in Mesopotamia, up to the north to Ebla, and then back into Mesopotamia, but that's been rejected too by certain scholars. They don't know where the predecessors of Ebla came from. The Bible gives some insight and information, and yet the Pergate Price would declare to the world that the predecessors of the great civilizations will have to be found on this, the American continent, and that following the flood there had been a dispositional transfer of peoples into the Mesopotamian area. Not that there weren't also predecessor city-states and empires also there prior to the flood, but many things you see arise now for consideration and reevaluation. We can use the LDS restored documents and the Book of Mormon, the Pergate Price, to reevaluate history as such, because much of what is now being found confirms Mormon doctrines and Joseph Smith as a prophet. We can no longer routinely assume that the first use of Sumerian cuneiform to transcribe a Semitic language was at Akkad, that great city where Sargon had had his empire. He was probably one of the first great conquerors of all time. Did Ebla borrow the Sumerian inventions of writing, or was it independent? It was from Ebla rather than from Akkad that other nations, perhaps such as Mari, borrowed the cuneiform in their turn. Whole questions of this kind arise. In short, Ibram or some other among the kings of Ebla may now have to be recognized as the great Alexander or one of the great Alexanders of all time, Sargon's rival in building the world's first international culture and empire. A little bit of background, too, might help to evaluate some of the things we want to comment in terms of their parallels. A gradual recovery, restoration and translation and the interpretation of Sumerian library works and literary works coming from about 3000 BC have proved to be a major contribution of our century to the studies of the ancient Near East. Now, these are the Sumerian texts. These are not Ebla. This is a book on the Sumerians, their history, culture, and character. It's supposed to have been one of the very large and first. That book will have to be revised as well in terms of content and implications. As of today, they have accumulated among the Sumerian tablets found in other areas, 5,000 literary tablets and fragments. Over 3,000 of these were excavated by the University of Pennsylvania in 1889 to 1898, but they've been distributed throughout many other museums. Piecing together translation and interpretation began seriously not until 1930. Sumerian literary works excavated include 20 myths, 9 epic tales, many parallels to Noah, like the Epic of Gilgamesh and Upnapishtim, 50 songs and many lamentations, liturgical dirges, and even numerous school essays and debates, and dozens of collections of proverbs and precepts. That's why they use a great deal of this for the background of the Old Testament. But there had been many misconceptions and premature conclusions regarding the Old Testament origins and origins of many stories in Genesis. Now that all has to be revised because we're thrust back 1,000 years before Moses assembled his documents. It was the British Museum that launched Sumerian literature on the modern scholarly scene in 1875. That's nearly 100 years ago. And, of course, there was a great magnificent series of cuneiform publications found by the father of Assyriology, which is the science of anyone who studies these ancient type of tablets with that type of writing. He was Henry Rawlinson. If you read his life, it's exciting. It's almost tragic, the things he suffered and experienced, how he persisted, the dangers that he underwent in order to bring to the world cuneiform translations. The examination and cataloging of the vast museum collections are now going on very rapidly. There's a good hope that many more literary documents will be recovered, identified, and many more excavations now in progress, being conducted at Nippur, Warka, Larsa, Isan, Ilhiba, and elsewhere, will make similar discoveries. Tel Mardik is not what would ordinarily have been thought of as a promising place to date for the further recovery of such literature and ancient things. However, the tablets found there will be, if anything, more intriguing on that account. Nearly 50 years ago, the oldest known map in the world was discovered at modern Yorgantepe, a mound 10 miles southeast of Kirk in Iraq. It was on this map that the city of Ebla had been located. The temptation to establish today at least the western boundary of the map identifying this Nuzi Ebla with the Syrian city now being excavated has been made by Dr. Hizda Friedman, and others are trying to make similar parallels. Now let's see what the text contained a little bit more in terms of background. Exciting to the archaeologists as they may be, scanning some of the tablets, excitement has almost grown to delirium. Inscribed on some of the tablets, of course, in mixed logograms or symbols. And I mentioned them already, but there are also names. Have you heard such names as Abraham, Esau, David? There was at least 10 references to David in the Ebla text. Outside of the Old Testament, David had never been found before. And this is 1,000 years before his name had been used in the Old Testament. And Michael, Saul, Israel, Abram, these are common names in the Ebla text, showing that the Bible has a thrust of history back into antiquity. The brass plates of the Book of Mormon now take on very salient and importance that needs now not to be ignored. To ignore the Book of Mormon would be at one's own peril. The tablets contain references to the cities of Hazar, Megiddo, and Giza, all familiar to anyone who reads the Bible. But the most startling reference of all, of course, is to Jerusalem. Yes, an unmistakable reference to the city of Jerusalem. And to Salem, ruled by Melchizedek probably within a couple hundred years of the time of the Tablets of Ebla, and where Melchizedek and Abraham resided for some period of time. The tablets also include stories recounting a great flood and the creation of the world. In fact, one of the tablets mentioned that the city had not been conquered since the flood. David Friedman, the University of Michigan, a biblical scholar, widely known and much revered, the current president of the Society of Biblical Literature, which I'm a member, and a widely regarded expert in this field, was so intrigued by the first reports of Tel Merdik that he traveled to Rome personally to talk to the two individuals personally who had been working on the excavations in the summer of 1976. On his return from Rome, Friedman enthusiastically commented, "Previous reports and rumors do not begin to indicate the true dimensions of the discovery and its importance for ancient Near Eastern and biblical studies. A new chapter in the Near East has been opened, and it will not be closed for some time. The Tel Merdik tablets will, in all probability, cast a bright new light on the early history of the Hebrews. We may say at this early stage of investigation," Friedman declared, "that the new discovery shall tell us much about the background and the origin of the peoples who later become Israel. Without making rash claims or jumping to unwarranted conclusions, we can say that the new tablets will make a very important indirect contribution to the understanding of the scriptures, and that they may prove to be some more direct connections as well." Of course, we should be cautious in some of these areas. Then in 1968, of course, the identification of the city of Ebla marks a milestone in history, in discovery, in archaeological recovery. Now interpretation begins. The great king of Ebla was then apparently perhaps Abram, whom the Hebrews called Eber in Genesis 10:24-25 and 11:14-17. There was a tantalizing suggestion, says one scholar, Dr. Friedman, that the biblical genealogy and tradition go back to this king, though there is no evidence than the identity of the name. So they'll be checking that out to see if they can verify. Hundreds of place names are recorded in the economic and diplomatic texts. There was an ancient, very ancient detente between the Ebla, and there were 22 separate articles in the details of a treaty. Two tablets dealt with a case of law. And in one of them, we have the first Canaanite code. So many things had to be revised. Many of the tablets have religious connotations, the mythological, cultic, and ritual texts, such as incantations and spells found in a number of the tablets should, says Dr. Friedman, provide us with background information on the religion which the Israelites opposed so vehemently, because there's also much of dealing with the false gods and the other gods. In fact, some of the tablets refer to more than 500 gods and goddesses of Ebla. Deities mentioned include Baal, Ishtar, and Chemosh. Deities also mentioned in the Bible. King Solomon once introduced the worship of Chemosh into Jerusalem just to placate one of his foreign wives and lost his exaltation and kingdom. Friedman and other scholars have been electrified by the parallel between the language of the tablets and the language of the ancient Hebrews. Eblite, as Friedman refers to the language, seems to be a West Semitic form unlike Sumerian, Akkadian, or any of the other ancient languages known. The tablets with their names and stories are perhaps closer to the Old Testament than anything that has yet been found. The names are particularly striking. Many, if not most, of the important names in the Bible have been identified and found in these ancient tablets in their identical form. Friedman states, if the patriarchs and their documents and descendants did not actually live in Ebla, they clearly belong to the same cultural tradition and came from the area in which the tradition survived. Now, since the main body of the palace has not yet been uncovered, Friedman and others hope that a treasure trove of tablets is still to be found. Should the royal archive be found intact, there is no way to calculate either the size or the importance of such a collection. But in view of what has turned up, the possibilities stagger the imagination. Now, no archaeological find since the Dead Sea Scrolls has excited the public imagination as the recently discovered and already famous Ebla tablets. Some of you may have seen the New York Times, or you may have seen the Watchman, the archaeologists, a number of Western papers here as well. And the two discoverers who made the great discovery of Ebla have been traveling internationally. They have made several international tours, some in the United States here just a year or two ago. They have given lectures, which have drew audiences of thousands of people. And right today now, there's over 200 publications on the tablets of Ebla. Of the first 17,000 tablets which were discovered, the inventories now in the literature only cover 2,644, so it's going to take a long time to get through all the tablets. And of these, only seven are based directly on the tablets themselves in terms of the articles. And there's only a report of 115 of the inscriptions so far available. So all we have now, which I'm telling you about, is the beginning, just a trickle. When things really get out and are available, it's going to be tremendous to see their content. When Mattai, the young archaeologist, first suggested that the site was ancient Ebla, as I mentioned, he had been opposed. Now, of course, he's famous, along with his associates. But there's some conflict internally. And we hope that it won't create a situation that will be difficult in the availability of texts and ongoing activity there. One text from Tel Mardik, which is surely destined to have lasting fame, indicates that Ebla even ruled the ancient city of Mari, which has to revise history. And I mentioned to you the general in Dagon who had conquered Mari. Another text tells how that Mari had to pay 2,193 minas. Now, I'm a geologist, and I'm quite interested in silver, so this may be tedious to you, but that amounted to 2,212 ounces of gold that was given and 39,394 ounces of silver that was paid in tribute. And that's a lot of silver and gold. So the question always comes up, where are their mines? I want to go look. I want to go find them. Note that Abraham paid for the cave of Machpelah when he wanted to bury Sarah in silver. In Genesis 23, and Abraham was born about 2052 B.C., within about 100 years or so of the destruction of the city of Ebla, its first burning. It may not have been totally destroyed because it resumed some importance thereafter for a few hundred years. But it's interesting that that portion of Genesis has also confirmed that the patriarchs and ancients seem to deal with silver as the main item of commerce. After the destruction of Ebla by Naram's sin, the city naturally lost most of its international importance. The archives and the tablets all date from the period of the empire, prior to the empire being destroyed by Naram-Sin. So nearly every tablet that's available right now goes back before 2250 B.C., and some might even go back to 3300, or reflect information of some predecessor activities back to that time. A disagreement has arisen as to the exact dates of the empire. One archaeologist prefers it 2400 to 2250 B.C. Another wants to throw it back to 2580 to 2450 B.C. Dr. I.J. Gelb, the University of Chicago's distinguished Sumerologist, and I have several of his articles here and publications before me, he would like to push the date of the palace and the archives to a time earlier than either of the two archaeologists working on the site. And he also prefers some other identifications of some of the languages. On the basis of vocabulary, grammatical signals, and sentence structure, Pettinato, one of the archaeologists, concluded that this heretofore unknown language was more closely related to Hebrew, so he gave it a new name. But Gelb would like to say it's just another new language, but related to the other eight Semitic languages of the type. So they'll have to go through all the tablets and come up with a conclusion sometime. But if we were to date the age of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to around 2000 B.C., the tablets of Ebler were written within a century or two of their time. It would be the same thing as if they had available to them material of the 1776 rebellion of the United States to refer to. The patriarchs, therefore, would have known and probably had material and evidences of Ebla. And undoubtedly, as close as Haran was, where Abraham lived for a number of years, he must have known of the city of Ebla because it was still flourishing in his time and 200 years after his death. If other cities parallel to Abraham's relatives continued to appear in Ebla archives because there were many references to cities familiar to Abraham, then, of course, there would be strong evidence that Abraham's family was well established in the region. And also there's an indication from some of the tablets that there's a different city called Ur, a northern city, that perhaps this was where Abraham was born and where he departed from to go to Haran, because there's a reference to a northern city of Ur near the great larger city of Haran, and the articles have appeared on that. David Noel Friedman, on the basis of the parallel between Ibrahim and Eber, has boldly suggested in a recent article that this identification of Eber could be direct. But, of course, that'll have to be worked out. Another issue, which is likely to be disputed for some time, is the suggestion that the cuneiform symbols, or syllables, IA, at the end of some of the Ebletic names, represents the divine name of Yahweh, Jehovah, a contraction of Jehovah, the biblical God of the Hebrews. Now, my son will be dealing with this more in great detail, but Anson Rainey was quick to point out in print in an article that the IA name is merely an abbreviated form of a name which was originally much longer. This would be in agreement also with the Book of Mormon, which also used the principle of the Hypocrustion, which is a condensation of the name Jehovah into a form. He'll give you more details on that particular element, particularly on the discoveries of Elephantine. There are many areas here we could discuss. Professor Gelb has reminded other individuals that the cuneiform sign, which has been read as IA and interpreted as Yah or Jehovah, can also be read as NI. But in the Book of Ether, the Book of Mormon, there is confirmation of the preferred use of IA. And so again, these documents and tablets will shed light upon the Book of Ether. The Book of Mormon turns out to be totally consistent with these great discoveries. And we could have actually predicted, on the basis of a careful study of Ether and the Book of Mormon names, that we would find evidences prior to 600 B.C. and older, or about that time, of documents that would confirm. Joseph Smith in no way could have conjured up these kinds of things. Until the discoveries of Ebla, scholars have looked principally to Mare to illuminate the background of biblical prophecy. At Ebla, however, a cognate word is used for the first time referring to a group of prophets. We can be certain that Ebla will make a significant contribution, says this author, to the vexed question of prophetic origins. Pettinato himself has promised to address himself to this question in a future article. There is much to be done, therefore, before biblical historians can now take a new look at their scholarly puzzles. Near Eastern historians must review the already growing information. It's an exciting time for scholars. The rest of us, we have to wait. Now, a few other things that are contained in Ebla. In 1976, in July, the 24th Great Assyriological International held in Birmingham. These conferences, which are held occasionally, were able to devote themselves to a great extent to the book of and discoveries of Ebla. There will be a great confirmation as they go over the tablets of old institutions and cultural common traditions. I'm going through some pages of material here now and just bring to your attention some final things. The city had a population of 260,000. It spoke a language close to Hebrew. It worshipped a god named Yah, or Jehovah. And in one of the documents, we might give you some background here. There were four types of tablets. The largest are economic, second were lexical texts, the third were historical, and the fourth were literary texts. Many of these were, of course, most interesting. The mythological tablets are most exciting, written as they are in this ancient language. They deal with Mesopotamian deities such as Enki and Enlil, as well as Utu and Inanna. Now, in the pearl of great price, in the facsimile that you'll find there, which shows four gods underneath a table upon which Abraham has drawn a diagram showing how he was going to be offered up as a sacrifice, Joseph Smith identified certain gods of Mesopotamia. And in the ancient languages, of which there are two types that probably you should be familiar with, the Sumerian language itself is what we would call agglutinative, which means that it is formed of roots that themselves do not change, and that you add separate elements. And then you have the Akkadian language, which the language is related to, where the roots can change, therefore they're inflected. And you can actually compose many words in terms of name, gender, and tense and everything by simply the insertion of vowels. And normally there's only three consonants involved. Now Joseph Smith properly used the consonants and even double vowels in many instances of his writings. And he only used eight consonants to identify the gods in that particular facsimile. And he used those consonants in the same patterns and the same consonants used for the gods found in the tabs of Ebla. Where could Joseph Smith have got the detail? The gods attested in Ebla, as I mentioned, number about 500. One of them was Jehovah. The first reference to Jehovah in 1,000 years. In fact, in Exodus, it actually makes a reference to the fact that he had not been known as Jehovah before. But Joseph Smith in the Restoration said he had been known as Jehovah from the time of Adam. Now the Ebla text confirmed Joseph Smith in confrontation with the Old Testament. Jehovah is still considered a crux interruptum so far as it could be read so far, and it can be understood as a hypocharisticon, a shortened form. But the alternative, of course, is rather interesting. Right after Eber became king, almost all the people changed their name and added Jehovah on the tail end of their name. It became rather interesting. Now, the new fact revealed by the tablets is this. While till the reign of Abram, all personal names contained the theophorous element of El, Elohim. With Abram becoming king, El was substituted far by Jehovah. Here, I merely note the fact, but it appears evident that under Abram, a new development in West Semitic religious concepts took place that permitted the rise of Jehovah, and then the use of certain forms, and you'll find it consistent with both the Book of Mormon and the Book of Ether, since the Book of Ether goes back to about this time. The Book of Ether goes back to 2500 B.C. The form Yahweh may be considered a shortened form of Jehovah, and may be inferred from such personal names such as Sumaya. You'll find many of the IAH forms in the Book of Mormon. Passing on to the divine cult, we note the existence of temples already attested to Dagon. Remember, Samson pushed the pillars of the temple at Dagon. Among the offerings are also an interesting thing. Can you imagine offering to the gods of Ebla a sacrament of bread and wine? Joseph Smith, the inspired version of the Bible, pointed out that the true order sacrament had been held in every dispensation, and he pointed out that Melchizedek, being the priest of the Most High God, he broke bread and blessed it and gave to Abraham. Now, Dr. Friedman points out a few other things as well that we'll probably try to prepare in a future tape to be a sequel. All we've done is give you an introduction to encourage you to read, study, and to be alert of the things that are going on, the Kingdom of Ebla and its archives. I bear you my testimony that these discoveries and others found in page 24 and 25 of the Book of Mormon are confirming Joseph Smith as a prophet. In Christ's name, amen.